Hello, I'm Matt Welch, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there, please. The Reason Podcast is where we talk with Reason smarty pantses, and I think that is the correct use of the plural, about the news of the day and the week. I'm in the moderator's chair here in our Park Slope Bureau. And from Washington, D.C., we have Reason Editor-in-Chief, Catherine Mangu Ward, ReasonTV.com, whatever else, Editor Nick Gillespie, and Senior Editor Peter Suderman. Please tell me that the three of you are all huddled around that simple mic in the grisly closet in the D.C. Bureau.
It's actually a fire, and we're making s'mores.
And singing doo-wop hits from the early 60s, because we know you love that kind of music, Matt.
Thank God that we weren't recording the pre-podcast conversation, or if we are, this is my call out to please bury it forever. Today, we intend here to talk about sex crime whataboutism, the alleged fascist takeover over the internet, which I blame on Nick Gillespie, and hopefully we'll have time to get to the New York Times Nazi Next Door article and apology thereof and other things having to do with that. Plus, and this is exciting, a super secret opportunity just for you all out there in loyal Reason Podcast listener land. But first, let's talk a little bit about the sex crimes. Over the weekend, Donald Trump tweeted, and I know that's a surprise, the last thing we need in Alabama and the U.S. Senate is a Schumer Pelosi puppet who is weak on crime, weak on the border. He's just capitalizing everything. Bad for our military and our great vets, et cetera, et cetera. Jones would be a disaster. Nancy Pelosi then said, hold my beer, and went on, I think, Meet the Press over the weekend and asked about John Conyers, longtime congressman, whose the reporting has been that he's settled some sexual harassment problems in Congress. And she says, John Conyers is an icon in our country. He has done a great deal to protect women, Violence Against Women Act, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact is John reviews his case, which he knows, which I don't. I believe he will do the right thing. Kind of word salad. They quickly sort of retreated from that. And now John Conyers has stepped down as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I'm going to start opening the questioning here to Peter Suderman. Suderman, can you tell us, without looking at any notes, how many terms John Conyers has served in Congress?
Too many.
That's not an accurate, well, that is an accurate answer. The answer is 27. He is a 27-term congressman. I don't even know how many years that is, Catherine. 27 times two. That seems like a lot here. Suderman, you were boiling with rage before we hit the record button here.
At Conyers, I should be clear.
Though, lump him in there. Go ahead. Don't be shy.
It's all-purpose rage.
What is the source of your all-purpose sex-based rage, Peter?
Wow, that's a really personal question for a Monday podcast. But I think, you know, look, in the case of Roy Moore versus John Conyers versus Al Franken, which I really want to see that world wrestling, I will pay the cable $80 like my friends did. And I was always sad that I couldn't when I was in fifth grade to watch that wrestling match. What we are witnessing is just the dumbest, ugliest, shallowest, knee-jerk kind of partisan reactions here. I mean, Trump in particular, you know, tweeting that Doug Jones is weak on crime. This guy's a former prosecutor in AUSA, right, in Alabama, where he prosecuted two Ku Klux Klan members for bombing the 16th Street Baptist Church. I mean, this is just not somebody who is weak on crime in any meaningful sense. He's, in fact, probably somebody who is startlingly, harsh on crime, especially for a Democrat. And I mean, the entire thing just sort of reeks of dead end, go nowhere, don't care about any kind of policy or actual governance partisanship. But that is so much of what Washington and in particular leadership in Washington has become. The sort of top ranks of both parties are just out to defend their own members and nothing else. They have no agendas, no ideas. They're not there to do anything. And I mean, you know, Pelosi, you know, I don't want to say to be fair, but to contextualize this, fairness is not what I'm going for here. But to contextualize this, Pelosi has faced kind of minor revolts or potential revolts for acting critically about her members when they've done things like, you know, be found with giant stashes of cash that they shouldn't have. So she is acting out of an awareness that she has to do this. At the same time, this is the expectation amongst legislators, amongst the caucuses in Congress on both the left and the right. And it's a terrible thing. It gets us nowhere. It has nothing to do with good governance, with good policy. It has everything to do with just protecting your own and your own right to power for no reason whatsoever.
Catherine, it sounds like Peter has become a social justice warrior. So my question to you is is there any daylight where the difference worth talking about in the cases or in the camps of cases, the Democrat tranche of cases and the Republican tranche of cases here and then the reaction?
No, not really. I think that there's an extremely strong temptation to say, oh, look at these social conservatives who turn out to be humans with bad morals and bad sex practices. They're worse than the liberals who turns out to be humans with bad morals and bad sex practices, because as we all know, hypocrisy is the worst thing of all. And somehow it's more hypocritical to be a conservative with bad sex practices than a liberal with bad sex practices. Like, this is, if we're doing Roy Moore versus Al Franken, Roy Moore is worse than Al Franken.
But that's on what not, he did, but the sort of partisan reaction is
right,
what we're talking
about.
But
the partisan reaction is identical. And to pretend that there are differences in the crimes which warrant the different partisan reaction is pure fabrication.
Nick, as always, I think this news proves that the 2011 book, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian
we know
Politics
you wrote a
Can
book.
Fix What's Wrong with America, was a prescient right. No, what I mean to get on with that is...
Well, we had that whole chapter about Al Franken groping
true.
At county fairs, so...
It yeah, was more
we
the...
Were, we really called that one.
It's the groping of the teddy bear, or bunny rabbit, or whatever, which is a doctored photo, by the way. So don't believe that that's true. No, are we doomed to a near term kind of endless cycle of statutory rapist versus statutory rapist, pedophile versus pedophile, and so on and so on, simply because we're in this kind of paradoxical time when party allegiance, as an overall thing, is shrinking? But the dead enders are dead ending even more, so that their seats are safer. Humans are much more kind of sorted geographically and politicized. I mean, 27 terms in Congress for John Conyers. What can't he do and keep his job? So is that what we're going to see for the next 10 to 20 years?
Yeah, part of Conyers' defense is, well, look, he's feeble-minded because he's ancient. So he, you know, you can't expect him to really act responsibly, which in and of itself is telling. I think, you know, it's important not to fold this in, I think, into a partisan political narrative, because the stuff about sexual harassment and about sexual assault, and then more broadly, just kind of sexual politics, for lack of a better term, and kind of the way, you know, kind of the way that genders interact. That's a broad, not a broad story, obviously, no jokes, but it's a big story that is generational and it's changing. Like, we are flushing out a set of behaviors that up until, you know, really a couple of months ago were completely acceptable or were mostly tolerated. And I think we're turning a corner there, and it very much is tied to, you know, kind of the descent of older people off of the stage and millennials and other people coming on. It's like in the same way that you could have kind of racism, you know, open racism discussed up through the late 60s or into the 70s, and it was tolerated in polite society. By 1980, that was gone. And I think we're seeing that. And that's a huge story, because in the end, I think it's those kinds of broad-based cultural changes that actually are what define where America is going and what's good or what's bad about it. in the political arena, you know, it is important to keep in, you know, perspective what Al Franken is accused of is very different than what Roy Moore is accused of or what John Conyers is accused of. And it's worth keeping making those distinctions because there should be justice of some sort to the perpetrators of horrible behavior that is criminal, not just impolite or anything like that. And there should be standards for elected officials or people who are standing for office. So that's another story. And then on the partisan side, you know, to get to the kind of story of the two big parties, and Matt, that obviously this is what we talked a lot about in the Declaration of Independence. What's positive about these developments, and when you see, you know, Christian pastors and ministers standing up for Roy Moore, and when you see Nancy Pelosi, you know, standing up for John Conyers and defending him, like, it is, these are the last wobbly legs of a table that is holding up a big pile of crap from the past 50 years of American politics. And it is going to, those legs are going to snap and it's going to come down. And I think this type of behavior is speeding up, you know, the end, but it's going to be it's going to be super ugly until it's fully over. And we're not sure what's going to come in the wake. But, you know, the fact that people like Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, who is, you know, he's very conservative. He's got some libertarian tendencies. He's genuinely and generally principled. Like, when people like that are hounded out, not because he is a squish or he's a Soviet dupe or anything like that, but because he refuses at various points in his career to be a blind partisan to a party that is insane. And there are people on the Democratic side of the aisle as well. When those people get attacked for not being team players, we've reached a certain limit. And the question is just when are we going to stop that and start with something new? And I don't think we know when we're going to start with something new. But so there are at least three issues to talk about. And I do think the most important stuff and the only stuff that's going to matter in another 5 or 10 years is that broad-based cultural change about how people interact on a regular basis of different genders. And I think we've turned that corner.
Catherine, isn't the tables and chairs and legs metaphor a bit wishful thinking here in the sense that we always going to have tribalism? You can even come up with new tribes, but you're always going to have Dinesh D'Souza, the douchebags, talking about how it's important to rally behind the alleged statutory rapist because it's going to cause the media to cry delicious tears. Don't you think that's always going to be with us, that type of
apologia? Yeah, and it happens not just in politics, right? It happens all over the place that if it's your guy who's doing something awful, then it's easy to excuse that awful thing because the thing he's doing that's good is just so gosh darn important to my team. And, you know, you can easily, without even trying hard, and everyone already has, trace this back at least as far as the feminist defense of Bill Clinton. And so we march bravely into 2017 where, you know. But even in Hollywood, what did you hear? Remember when Weinstein put out that crazy letter after he got caught for the umpteenth time and it was finally public and he said, like, okay, well, I'm going to go after the NRA.
Yeah, but nobody bought that. And I mean, you know, the New York Times, the New Yorker, people who were on his team.
Nobody bought it that time. But the reason he said it is because people have bought it before. Because lots of people buy that sort of stuff all the time.
Even Bill Clinton. But this is where I don't disagree that there's always going to be tribalism. But
yeah, sure. Don't get me wrong here. I think this is clearly evidence of the arc of history bending toward, you know, the end of men or something. But
towards the Declaration of Independence.
Stop! Not you too. You know, I think this is very obviously a good thing. I think it's a good thing that's happening largely in the private and cultural sphere. I'm a little bit worried about the lagging legislation that's going to happen. Like 6 months from now, somebody's going to wake up and be like, we got to make laws about this thing that all of society is already moving in the right direction on, because that's what we do. And boy, are they going to be dumb laws.
This goes to the part of the podcast where I just start openly reading what's on the Reason Slack channel, just to give people a peel back on the onion, but also to to toss Nick's generational culpability right on it. Breitbart senior editor defends Judge Roy Moore, citing Ringo Starr's hit cover of the song "You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine." Nick, I'm only going to give you 30 seconds, but was every single pop song in the 1970s
29 seconds too much?
Only the hits, Matt. Oh, and then there's also the Swingers, if you throw in the Pina Colada song.
That's true. That might be.
When you see the Pina Colada song as like a bourgeois defense of swinging compared to Chevy Van or pretty much anything by Chuck Berry or Ringo Starr.
The defenses of Roy Moore are just really kind of delightfully awful. My favorite is the pastor.
Yes.
Who said he, Roy Moore, did that because there is something about a purity of a young woman. There is something that is good, that's true, that's straight, and he looked for that. This is an Alabama pastor, Flip Benham, on an Alabama radio show talking about, why it's just perfectly okay.
The name flows off like a tip of the tongue, Lolita.
Also, you'll recall the very first defense out of the gate, which was the, it's all right because the Virgin Mary was also a teenager defense.
Yeah, and Joseph was a district attorney.
And a successful carpenter and district attorney or something.
Yeah. Joseph was a cock. Let's
go.
I was going to say thank you for using the word cuck correctly, which we've lost to history already, I think.
What do you think the equivalent of a mall was back then?
A manger?
Wait, Peter, are you saying in the 1980s or are you saying in the BCE era? I'll tell you what a mall was in the 80s. It was fucking great. And it was probably newly enclosed. And they didn't have these terrible stores like Wet Seal. It was all Spencer Gifts and Radio Shacks mostly.
Free Hot Topic?
God,
yeah. Hot Topic was actually around on the West Coast, but not on the East Coast yet.
Nick knows because he's been shopping there for the last 45 years.
I'll kind of throw this open to everybody, but let Suderman take the first crack if he has it. Is there any story in the post-Weinstein universe where you thought to yourself, this person's getting a raw deal?
Awkward silence Suderman. While Peter tries to think of something that won't get him strung up, but is also true.
Catherine, I'll go.
Yeah, Matt, you go first on this one.
Everyone's all scared. I'm hoping I'm getting the name right, but Jerry Moran, the Washington or the Texas Republican congressman.
Joe Barton. Jerry Moran is a Republican senator from Kansas, I believe. Yeah, Joe Barton.
No, yeah. Oops. Martin.
Yep.
Sorry. They all sound like these Republicans. It seems that he had a consensual relationship in between wives with a woman who then shared, at least semi-publicly.
Yeah, it's not clear if she's responsible for leaking the images, but images of him naked and also video of him masturbating, supposedly. I agree that that got outed, and that's awful. And it really is the definition of revenge porn, if people believe in that. One way or the other, because it's sharing intimate photos without consent of the people in it. But I think, one of the stories that's good about that is that, the guy is not like a super Christian, conservative or anything, but I don't think people really care. I'm sure it's intensely embarrassing for him. But I think it's a good thing. And it's a sign that we're growing up as a society where people aren't like, oh, he was naked and he was having consensual sexual relations, so he should go to hell and leave office. People are kind of like, oh, that's embarrassing. And you go and try and find the picture to look at it once, but nobody really gives a shit. I think that's a positive sign.
Actually. I mean, we want transparency from our legislators, obviously, right?
Let's make a hard pivot from sex crime to the alleged rape of the internet, which happened last week.
That was a segue. That was great.
Look,
I hate to be a PC, but that's a bad segue, Matt.
But you know what? The life is full of risk.
No,
out here
I fully
edge,
support it. That was a great segue. Net neutrality, let's do it.
Without net neutrality, I'm not going to be able to pull up the Picard double facepalm gif that I think this segue needs.
At any rate, last week, the Federal Communications Commission chair, Ajit Pai, announced that he is going to be proposing for a December vote to roll back the 2015 suite of regulatory activity that is colloquially known as net neutrality. Basically, and everyone who I'm talking to on this podcast has this better than I do, but it's basically a precautionary principle set of regulations on internet companies to make sure they don't do something that almost nobody was even thinking about doing or doing back then, which is sort of discriminating against other companies and content providers on the internet. He's rolling it back so that Title II of the Telecommunications Act of 1934 will no longer, if this is voted indeed in December, will no longer be used to regulate internet companies. And we'll go back to the light touch regulatory scheme that we had the first two decades of the internet. I'm interested first in kind of like reflecting on the reaction to this, which I don't know about y'all's Twitter feeds, but mine has been filled with like tech journalists saying things like, I you know what? I've never met a single person in favor of what Ajit Pai has done. I'm just shaking my damn head. I'll start with Suderman on this. Peter, you wrote a great piece for Reason Magazine about 6 years ago talking about the original push for net neutrality back then. And I think some of the impulses behind that original push and some of the belief systems among those who were pushing for it might tell us a little bit about what I believe to be a really hysterical reaction that we're going to end the wild and woolly free internet as we know it. So give us a bit of a historical heft, if you would, about that so that we can understand why it is that people are freaking out so much about this.
Like virtually all federal policy debates these days, this really kind of started in the Bush administration and then blew up under President Obama. During the Bush administration, there was a movement at the FCC towards a kind of a net neutrality guidelines that were put in place. And then this really kind of the ball really got rolling on this during the 2008 campaign when President Obama made this a big part of his campaign. And there was a big part of the kind of core young tech-savvy Obama support activists who were really, really in favor of net neutrality. And so under President Obama, implementing net neutrality, and just for sort of purposes of people who don't kind of have a clear sense of what this is, because it is pretty vague, it's a basic idea that ISPs, that internet companies, people who own the pipes of the internet, should treat each piece of information equally. And I think it's basically a decent idea in principle, perhaps not as regulation. And so this was something that really kind of blew up under President Obama, and they tried to do this a couple of times in a couple of different ways, basically through the FCC, through regulation to say, this is what we're going to require ISPs to do. And the courts consistently came back and said, you guys don't have the authority to do this under statute. There is no law that gives the FCC to regulate the internet this way and to regulate providers this way. And so what ended up happening was they decided, and under pressure from President Obama, who exerted, let's say, unusual influence over what is supposed to be an independent regulatory agency. Also, and in specific, came out himself lobbying very clearly, but also had staffers kind of secretly working on this and basically said, well, what we want is for you to find some way to do this under the law. And what that means is reclassifying the internet, not as a telecommunications service, which doesn't give the FCC power to do very much, but reclassifying it under Title II, basically as a utility and treating it like an old phone system style utility. And that gives the FCC a huge amount of power to regulate. And in fact, it gives them too much power. So one of the interesting things about the Title II reclassification is that in doing that, the FCC actually has to go through a forbearance process, which basically means, well, there's a bunch of stuff that we could do that's sort of called for under this title that we're not going to do because we all recognize that would be bad. But this kind of goes to what I think is the real problem with the Title II method of implementing net neutrality, which is that it's not a real set of rules. Instead, what it is a sort of preemptive mother may I permission system that sets up the FCC as the arbiter of ISP innovation. It means that companies that serve you internet, that serve you data, are going to have to go to the FCC basically anytime they want to do anything and figure out whether the FCC is going to agree to it or not, because it's not a set of rules that they can clearly look at and abide by. Instead, it is, well, if the FCC thinks you're doing something that we don't like, then the FCC is going to say you can't do that, and that's the rule. And that is a really bad way to go about regulation.
And Nick, just to tee you up, I mean, you did a great interview with Ajit Pai the day of, and he talks explicitly about what the impacts of that regulation has had over the last couple of years, which is something that somehow people don't really talk about.
One of the things that Ajit Pai pointed to in his conversations with a variety of people, including you over at the Fifth Column, Matt, as well as Reason, and in his public statements about repealing net neutrality rules, was that investment has gone down in internet infrastructure over the years that it was implemented. Exactly what that would mean in the long run is a bad thing. But it's also part and parcel of when you have, as Peter was talking about, regulations that are, you know, kind of everywhere, but then the FCC says as a bureaucracy, like, well, we're not really going to enforce all of this stuff, so just keep doing what you're doing, and we'll let you know if you're in trouble. That freezes investment, it freezes innovation, and it's fucked up. And I mean, this is, you know, Donald Trump, one of the many bad things that he's having an effect on is that because he is against the administrative state of federal agencies and bureaucracies making rules based on vague laws dictated by Congress, you know, now people are like, oh, well, you know, if Donald Trump is against something, I'm for it. They're totally right here. The FCC doesn't have statutory right to control the internet the way that it's doing. Its ability to reclassify, or the strategy, actually came from a court case where the federal judge said, you know what, like, you don't have the jurisdiction here. The FCC was rebuffed several times, but it's like, if you reclassified it under Title II, you know, that would make sense. And that's what the FCC ended up doing. And it's not good. Like, if Congress wants you know, net neutrality, they should pass a law dictating and defining what it is. Because at this point, as Peter was saying, it's a vague feel-good idea, basically that, you know, Comcast is not going to throttle Netflix traffic and just, you know, take money from them, which is not what happened, which people talk about. It's not even clear that it's actually a net neutrality violation, et cetera, but, or that you're not going to block particular sites. Nobody knows what net neutrality means. And even the person who kind of conceptualized the idea says that strict net neutrality, meaning treating all data and all traffic as equal, is stupid, and it's beyond, it's not how networks work. So, you know, we're in this position where we're freaking out over the idea of that if we go back to the internet circa 2014, every time you try to get to Reason, you know, there'll be a blank there, or it'll take 15 minutes for the site to load. That wasn't happening before. It's not going to be happening now. And for me, one of the biggest side issues here, or things that people are missing, is that net neutrality and the way people are talking about it, it's as if we're always going, that Comcast is always going to be a cable company, and you're always going to get you're always going to get your internet through a glass fiber or a coaxial cable coming through the wall, when a majority of web traffic is already mobile and it's shifting. And the idea that we should be freezing into place business models now at this stage of development is really stupid. And it's exactly the kind of bureaucratic thinking that led to a really long period of slow innovation in telecommunications because of the regulatory framework.
You mentioned reference, Nick, to the kind of pioneer or the architect of the phrase net neutrality, the concept. It's Tim Wu, if I have that correctly, how he's not necessarily in favor of what it became. Reminds me of some stories that Peter has done over the years about some of the people who have, the academics who have studied minimum wage. There's like one study out there in the universe, like a good study, that suggests that maybe if you raise the minimum wage, it doesn't have a negative effect on employment. And when those people were hit with, hey, so everyone wants now to have a $15 minimum wage, they're like, what, are you crazy? That's never been tried. It shouldn't be tried. You're out of your minds. But yet that's where we go because of political passions, which allows me to transfer over to Catherine here. Catherine, do you feel a sense of personal failure that you were unable to convince our friends at Boing Boing of how wrong they have been about this over the years?
Yes, I take it all on myself and I apologize. No, I mean, I think this is actually one place where there is a, you know, again, kind of in the original sense, you know, it can be, net neutrality can be an ethos. It can be just a way of thinking about all things being equal, ish, where do we want the internet to tend? Or it can be a sort of horrific, messy, chilling legal framework. And we've opted for the latter, and now we're rolling that back, which I think is good. But the idea of this is actually, I mean, if you want to get super deep about it, are you ready, y'all? Monday morning. It's differing ideas of what it means to be equal under the law or equal in the eyes of regulators or
is currently blocking my Galaxy Brain GIF.
Oh, no. The idea that equality demands that every single little bit of information from every person everywhere gets treated exactly the same, that it comes out of the pipe at the same speed. Sorry for that. Terrible metaphor. That's different than saying, okay, you know, equality is everybody gets a fair shot to buy services from the people who are selling them. And that doesn't sound as pretty. But, you know, the fact is, if you built the pipe, then you get to sell time in the pipe, and you should.
When people talk about it, it's always abstract, where it's like, oh, you know what, like Netflix will rebuffer and stuff like that. It's like, you know, between Netflix and Skype on any given moment, you're looking at, you know, a majority of internet traffic, depending on the time of day. And it's like, there's this idea that the internet is magic, that it doesn't require physical resources, that actually, you know, where you have to manage congestion because there's a lot of stuff. And it's like, yeah, you know, both the ISPs and the providers, Netflix, et cetera, they're going to have to pay for more capacity if they want.
The way that we allocate scarce resources are prices. That's how we do
The actual net neutrality cases or the ones that have come up mostly aren't even about the internet or, you know, they're not about fixed internet connections. It's more about things like T-Mobile, before that Metro PCS, which was a cheap discount phone company that didn't have, was using older technology, and they allowed for unlimited YouTube streaming, but not other types of video streaming. And that's considered a violation of net neutrality because it's like, you should be able to get all video or no video. I mean, the net neutrality discussion is taking place against the backdrop of like, I'm on Verizon, and Verizon recently, you know, kept going after me to actually switch from, I was getting something like 12 gigabytes of data a month. And they were like, hey, you know what, you can pay less money and get unlimited streaming of everything. Places like T-Mobile until recently had a thing where you could stream Spotify, Netflix, YouTube, about three dozen different types of streaming services, music and video, and it wouldn't count against your monthly cap. That's technically, if you take a hard line of net neutrality, that is a violation of net neutrality because it's saying, oh, YouTube is treated differently than a service that's not on that. And, you know, from a consumer point of view, which is where anti-competitive laws and antitrust law is supposed to be based on, does it help or hurt consumers? You're kind of fucked if you're like saying, oh, no, it's a bad idea that these fucking, you know, telephone companies or, you know, mobile carriers who we all hate, and we all hate our ISPs like we hate our electric company. Well, of course we hate them. But like all they're doing is giving us more shit for free or reduced prices at higher rates. And it just drives me nuts because the minute you start to take this stuff down to specific cases that have been challenged under these ideas, you start to realize that this isn't, you know, it isn't about making sure that the International Socialist Workers Party site is, you know, comes up quickly. It's about Netflix and it's about big and firms who say, oh, we want the free and open internet that allowed us to flourish, and we want the next guy who's going to put us out of business to have an equal shot. It isn't that at all. This is just incumbents in an industry, people who are in a good position, trying to lock in a regulatory framework and a mindset that, it, you know, has them at the top of the pyramid right now.
Here's your factoid for the day. In North America, peak evening hours, 35% of internet use is Netflix, and another 17.5% is YouTube.
The idea that the federal government can punish or adjudicate
Netflix's Marvel shows are pretty good.
Adjudicate a
punishment. The one with the dumb teenagers?
Meant.
Sorry.
Over a company for having prices that are too low is one of the great infuriators there. One of my favorite terrible cases of that was about 5 years ago when the San Francisco Bay Guardian, an alt weekly that dates from the Pleistocene era, tried successfully to exact a multi-million-dollar, I think it was $15 million was the price tag, against the SF Weekly, an upstart then, because the SF Weekly was selling ads for too cheap. And the federal government's like, yep, uh-huh, you got it. That's right. That's against our, that's anti-competitive, what you're doing there. That's usually a sign that you got to go back to the original laws and start ripping stuff up.
And think about this. Now we're not talking about YouTube demonetizing political videos or censoring people or taking down things or Facebook saying this is good news, this is fake news. All of, like, within these major platforms, which is where most of the activity on the internet lives in a lot of ways. You know, there's all sorts of stuff where, you know, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, they're all doing certain types of suppression of speech that they don't like. But we're not talking about that. Now we're talking about how, you know, Ajit Pai is a shill for Verizon because he used to work there. And we got to focus on that. And, you know, this is all like misdirection. The Wild West of the internet ended sometime, you know, at the very latest in the early 2000s, if not before. And we need to be building an ethos, I think, you know, of openness and of innovation and of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And obviously people who run platforms have every right to do whatever they want as long as they're transparent, or maybe even if they're not transparent. But that brings us back to Ajit Pai. His whole thing is that ISP should have more freedom and mobile carriers should have more freedom to set terms, but they need to be transparent to their customers about that. And then we will, you know, and if we actually change some of the regulatory frameworks that make it harder for ISPs to compete with one another, we'll all have more choices. And, you know, some of us, a lot of people just hang out on Facebook. I don't understand why they do that, but they like that kind of walled garden sensibility. Good for them. And other people want to have a different kind of filter or a different kind of internet experience. I mean, that should be the end point, not talking about this as if, oh, my God, you know, come mid-December when the FCC votes to repeal these things, you know, all sites are going to go dark. It's just a bunch of horseshit.
18 years ago, Suderman, there was the last, I think, great spasm of this is the end of the free internet as we know it. That was in response to the then proposed merger of AOL and Time Warner. The wild era of internet freedom is a wild libertarian era of internet freedom, said my friend Bob Scheer, is over as we know it because of this merger, which, of course, went on to become one of the most infamously impotent mergers in modern media history. Most mergers, especially when it involves editorial titles, end up fizzling and falling flat. But what I find interesting, and this harkens back to your article, Peter, is that it's a lot of the same people who were reacting in that way, who were starting organizations around that back then, who were talking about media monopoly, which is a phrase that I think has been mostly retired out of shame back then. But it's those same people who were pushing the drive for net neutrality. And it makes me wonder, is a large part of it because they got a really, really effective slogan? Are they proving that George Lakoff and I guess Frank Luntz or whoever else who obsess about phrases like the death tax, who obsess about how can you boil down an issue where it's just obvious that if you're on the other side of it, you are a monster? And you, Peter, as someone who really likes policy, are you just throwing up your hands at how sloganeering has come to dominate this conversation?
I think the slogan's part of it. Good slogans are important for selling hamburgers and ideas. Net neutrality is a quite good slogan for who's against net neutrality, right? Who's like, oh man, I'm for net not neutrality. Like nobody sort of thinks of themselves reflexively that way. But I also think that a huge amount of this comes from a kind of progressive left instinctive distrust of any kind of large corporation, and that it is just about, well, here's some big corporations that have a lot of influence because they own the rights to manage the sort of backbone of the internet, and therefore we should do everything we can to give regulators more power over them, regardless of whether they've done anything specific that we think is bad. So we don't actually have, and this is really what's kind of what continues to be striking about the pro-net neutrality case, is that they have so few examples of actual bad behavior that the ISPs have engaged in. And that is part of why the rules are so vague, and they are mostly about giving the FCC a kind of discretion to just sort of say, well, this is good and this is bad. And they make the case that, you know, if we do this on a case-by-case discretionary basis, then what that allows us to do is allow the good innovations. It allows us to get it right and only stop the bad stuff. But what it really ends up doing is massively empowering regulators to determine what innovations and what sorts of business and pricing practices are allowed, again, without any kind of with basically no strong and ongoing examples of bad behavior by ISPs. And so it's just a power grab for regulators. And it doesn't go much further than that.
It's also a great way to scare off entrepreneurs, right? I mean, this is, if you look at this space right now and you see that it's been a political football, that it's likely to revert back to some type of, you know, net neutrality system in the next administration, that you really don't know what the landscape looks like in 2 or 5 or 10 years, and it could be dramatically different at each of those junctures. As an entrepreneur, as someone who has some cool ideas about how to make the internet better, you're just going to say fuck it and go work in another area. You're going to build an app instead of building cable or something like that. And it's not, you know, this is part of the thing that you hear from these Tyler Cowen type guys about, you know, the place where innovations happen are not dramatic moonshot world changing infrastructure type projects. They're convenience projects, which I personally don't think that's the end of the world. I'm sort of fine with a world in which lots of cool people are trying to make my life easier and better every day. But this is at least part of the cause of that. It's because giant moonshot infrastructure type projects, the government increasingly reserves the right to just kill them at any stage for no freaking reason.
I think there's two things to think about. One is that this is effectively a culture war issue now. It's not really, it's not about the thing we're talking about. It's a way of affiliating. You're either with corporations and Republicans and Donald Trump and shitty phone companies who, you know, the only thing worse than the Ma Bell, monopoly is Verizon and AT&T and Sprint and all of these corporations somehow. Now they're, you know, we're wedded to our phones and, you know, they control us. That type of stuff. But it's a culture war issue now. And in most culture war issues, it has very little to do with how people actually live and act. And we should be mindful of that, because you can end up passing laws that end up fucking up the ability to build out new and better and different stuff. I think the other thing is that, you know, if you go back and you look at the rise of cable and to a lesser degree kind of satellite radio, people were pissed at the idea of having to pay for TV. Like, how dare you? TV is a birthright. It should be free. And every innovation, it took a long time, even after the regulations were changed so cable could roll out, to get people to say, oh, you know what? Cable is worth paying for, because you get much more stuff and you get a better picture and a reliable picture, et cetera. And we're going through a spasm of that, too, because we want ubiquitous, super fast, you know, completely reliable internet stuff all of the time. But we want other people to pay for it, you know, because it's like, you can't have it all, you know, that way. Like, somebody's got to pay for this shit. It doesn't, the drone doesn't show up on your door, you know, for free. Like, there's a lot of work and a lot of research and a lot of R&D that goes into that. And we're going to screw it up if we keep saying, no, maybe we'll let you go forward with that. Maybe not, et cetera. But ultimately it's a culture war issue.
I do think there, it's also about people's frustrations with their ISPs and a sense that the ISP market is not super competitive, which is both overblown and accurate in certain ways, but part of the reason that it's not competitive is because we have this massive mess of a kind of regulatory scheme where and licensing scheme for ISPs to get to homes and to sort of to get to solve the last mile problem. And so a huge part of that is that we have regulated the ability of Verizon and Comcast and Cox Cable and all of these large internet providers to provide service and given them kind of quasi monopolies. But a lot of the thinking around net neutrality is really kind of based in the idea that you have one internet provider that provides service to your home, and that's what the internet is. And if you look at, you know, Nick has already talked about this a little bit, but if you look at what's happened over the last decade, all of us now have a pretty clear choice, or whether it's a choice between, and that's between a sort of landline system and a mobile system. And even if those are your only choices, and we would like you to have more, for sure, we have more choice than we did 10 or 15 years ago. And we have more, and we are increasingly seeing a lot of people who choose to only or mostly access the internet through mobile devices and through mobile providers, which again, I would like to see even more choice in that market. But the whole idea of net neutrality is built out of this sense that, oh, there's only one, there can be only one, there will only ever be one, and therefore the government has to protect us from bad monopoly behavior. And I think it's a way of thinking about the internet that just sort of assumes that there can not ever be any innovation or change in the way that that information and that data is delivered to us. And the last decade, the last 15 years make very clear that that is not the case, and that we are and that an internet that does not have net neutrality rules is a dynamic internet that does lead to a lot of innovation. I mean, if you were to think about the first iPhone and its total inability to play online video, think about how new that is, that we can all access full-length movies from our phones wherever we are. And that is something that just a few years ago, people were saying, well, I'm not sure we'll ever really get there in a way that's affordable for most people. And it just didn't take that long. And so these sorts of innovations are the sorts of things that people just sort of assume can't happen. And that's why that is part of the appeal and part of the argument for net neutrality.
Well, and you think back, you know, I mean, this is particularly true of technology. And there's a very compelling Marxist analysis of this that, you know, capitalism erases its own history to decontextualize and then better control people. But you go back to the era of dial-up access to the internet,
which was not that long ago. It feels like ancient history.
The shift to a broadband connection, and I can remember when I got one, which was in like 97 or 98, and like you were always on. The internet was always on, and that changed your relationship to it, what was possible, what you conceived as possible. And we're going through that again now, because again, it isn't, you know, most people consume, you know, more traffic is consumed via your phone than via your fixed connection. And that's only going to get more and more different. Ajit Pai in the recent interview also, like, I asked him, okay, well, what are the markers, you know, that we can also say, because we should also be judging these policies. And one of the arguments against net neutrality is that it has, at least in a couple of years, it decreased investment in infrastructure and build out. That's a problem. He agreed that if the number of connections starts to go down, if the cost per connection go up and the speeds go down, that's a problem. If there is massive blocking, if there is massive streaming, et cetera, blockage or throttling, these are markers that we can say, okay, in 3 years and in 5 years, we can look back and say, is this working or not? And that also shouldn't be, you know, people keep acting like there's a fucking kill switch and that once the internet goes dark in mid-December, like, you know, we'll never be able to get the lights back on. And it's just, it's wrong. It's, and that goes to this whole hysteria in general. I mean, it's like we've never gotten out of the year 2K problem where every election is the most important election in our lifetime. That, you know, the world is in the balance, Earth in the balance. Everything is fucking always apocalyptic. And, you know, back in the 70s, at least it was only evangelical Christians and hardcore environmentalists who were saying the Earth was, you know, the world was ending every day. Now it's all of us in every goddamn issue, and it's getting a little bit much.
So speaking of what Nick was saying a little while ago about, you know, someone's got to pay for something. I think something like 97-98% of the content that Reason provides to all of you wonderful people out there is free, including this podcast. I'm pretty sure you didn't pay any money to listen to this wonderful podcast. Online, our offerings are free. Reason TV is free. YouTube and Facebook and on our website. Even most of our magazine content, although you never can fully replicate the actual physical, tactile, lovely pages of the magazine, for which you can subscribe for 15 bucks a year. It's super great. But even most of that stuff ends up on the website for free. However, we are organized as a nonprofit corporation, have been for a really long time, in order to give a sense of financial stability under it. And so as such, every year since 2008, we have been organizing a webathon in which we make a tin cup virtual and rattle it a little bit and say, hey, if you like all this free stuff, would you consider, before you blow all of your money on Christmas shopping, to give us a tip or two. Our webathon starts Tuesday. You, hopefully, are listening to this on Monday. I know how much a lot of you like to be the person who goes first in the comments section here. So what I'm saying here to everyone listening is that you have a chance right now, in theory, to be that person. Go to reason.com/webathon or reason.com/donate, and you can get there. You can be first. And if you are, and if you like this particular podcast, if that is your reason for the season, for the reason, mention it. We need that kind of feedback. Or if you hate the podcast or love the podcast and hate Nick, whatever. I'm not telling you what to write here. Please do that. And as kind of a rehearsal for this, we're going to have hopefully, if all the technology works, we're going to have a telethon with Catherine and Nick and I tomorrow, again, Tuesday, there. We're going to have a lot of posts on the website, hopefully kind of humorous and whatnot. But just kind of as a throat clear on some of this, I would like to do a quick go round here, starting with Peter Suderman on this, which is to say, Peter, how did you encounter Reason in the world, and when did it become part of your life and way of thinking?
Those are two different questions and two different answers. I first encountered Reason on a newsstand at a bookstore when I was working at a Books a Million, which had the very best magazine selection, and I loved magazines. Now, in particular, I loved, like, punk rock magazines and the sorts of weird, like, quasi-national distribution things that would review, you know, 500 albums every couple of months, because this was a kind of not quite pre-internet, but early internet era when music had not, and music journalism had not gone fully online. And so I enjoyed just sort of sitting around on my coffee break because they had a coffee shop in the bookstore. This was a thing, people. It was a huge thing. But at one point, I remember thinking, man, some of these political magazines look sort of interesting. And here is one that has a picture of someone's house, like, on the cover. And I opened it, and this was perhaps one of our most interesting covers historically, one that really got a lot of attention, deservedly so, for Reason, because what had happened, and Nick, you can tell this story better than I can, but someone had figured out how to put a satellite photo of the address that each issue was sent to on the cover of each magazine. So it was a personalized magazine. And I was just sort of in awe that this could happen, you know, in the world of printing and mass distribution, and that all of these things could sort of then be delivered out, and that you could, like, wow, this is a really neat sort of thing. And I don't think at that moment I fully grokked what a libertarian was and the distinctions between, say, the the Reason and National Review and the Nation's worldview. But I was like, man, this is really cool, and I'm really interested. And I followed it at least in the background for a while after that. Eventually moved to Washington, started working at a libertarian think tank. Quickly met some folks who worked here, and found out that, you know, if nothing else, Reason was the reason. people at Reason were really fun to drink with.
Nick, is that the best cover ever? Top three? What's your take? That's like 2003, 2004?
2004, yeah. And we did a mass personalization of about 40,000 plus covers where, as Peter was saying, it was a high quality aerial photograph of the address it was being sent to. And it had the name, the front cover, inside front cover, back cover, and inside back cover all had personalized information based on the congressional district, the zip code, et cetera, of people. And it was a demonstration project to talk about kind of personalization and the widespread loss of privacy through linked databases. We had a great story by Declan McCullough, the tech journalist who's now working at a startup, talking about the upside of zero privacy, which I think, well, you know, we've revisited a lot since then because there are many downsides as well, but nobody ever talks about the upside. Yeah, and it was, I think that's definitely in the top covers. It was a real keepsake. And we had a subscription promotion. We sold thousands and thousands of subscriptions because if people subscribed by a certain time, they would get this. I still hear people talking about it. For me, I started reading Reason in high school. My brother went to college ahead of me, and he found it at Rutgers in New Jersey, where he was an economics major, which is Milton Friedman had gone there as an undergrad. He started sending Reason back, and I was like, oh, that's pretty good. I wasn't particularly political at the time, but I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I believe that. And so it's always been a real pleasure to end up working for the publication or the platform that helped shape my my worldview. It's fun and exciting that way.
Catherine, you were presumably swaddled in like blankets hand-knitted by Marty Zupan and Virginia Postrel. How did you first encounter Reason, and how did you how old were you when you first knew that one day.
I wish that were true. Like a world in which Marty Zupan and Virginia Postrel were my two moms would be.
No, it's like the beginning of Wonder Woman. You're on Paradise.
Yeah, basically we're on this island full of libertarian women. It was. I mean, I am in fact a product of the libertarian industrial complex for sure. I first encountered Reason when it fell out of the post office box, which was affiliated with the Yale Free Press, the paper that I edited in college. And we got a bunch of magazine subscriptions, including Reason. And so somebody had given me the key. The editor of the Yale Free Press got like the key to our post office box as part of a formal ceremony, which was not at all a formal ceremony. And I probably literally got hit on the head by Reason because the post office box was really high up.
That is an inciting incident.
Yeah. And I started. No, because you know what? You know what I liked to read back in those days? The brickbats. I just opened it up, just read the brickbats. So all I remember is little Terry Colon doodles.
You did. No, because that you were already working at the magazine when they were illustrated by Terry Colon.
All right. There was somebody else's little doodles, but it would have been probably 1999, maybe. So I started reading Reason then, came and interned the summer of 2000 for Mike Lynch and, learned where to get free lunch in Washington. That was the main thing I learned because I was already such a hardcore nerdball libertarian that Reason had nothing left to teach me.
There's
my
the
friends.
First thing as a free lunch.
Yep, that's correct. And that was the great teaching of Mike Lynch.
I just want to point out that she only got in two references to Yale.
What
in
do
her
you
Oregon
want from
story,
me?
Which is really
Matt, what about you? Did you when do you expect to encounter Reason Magazine
That's an excellent and apropos question. The first time I believe it came in the 1980s, seeing it at my mom and stepdad's house. My stepdad, big libertarian, he's the first one who introduced me to or tried to introduce me to libertarian ideas. I think the only thing that really took hold was not necessarily Reason, which I had a hard time distinguishing typographically from Omni magazine, which he also subscribed to at the time. There was sort of a Reason Omni phase. But Robert Heinlein, I liked that because of all the wars and also sex. I thought that was pretty great. So I saw it, but it didn't have any kind of big waving of impact on me. Probably when it first started to impact me in for serious is when I came back to the country after living abroad for most of the 90s and started rooting around for intelligent, funny kind of commentary from my idiosyncratic point of view. And it turns out nobody has that point of view, but Reason comes pretty close. I just was sort of mesmerized by the what had been built up by Virginia, but especially Nick, just sort of the bleed over between Reason then and Suck.com was kind of a beautiful early internet 2.0 type of thing, which I felt at home at and still do to a degree that almost everything else in the world seems like this alien, hostile territory.
Matt, you did great. You only mentioned that you lived abroad in the 90s once in that answer.
And I didn't even mention Prague, which is pretty good.
Or your book.
What? Hey, you know what? That book
has a great Prague chapter.
Matt, was the first thing that you wrote for Reason, was it the Iraqi babies or the Iranian dead baby story?
That was the first thing for the print magazine. I wrote Nick. So after 9/11, when I had started a thing called the War Blog, and I think right now we're getting anti-donations on the Webathon here, and deservedly so. I still am part of the problem, Nick, as you well know. But the places that I had been writing for up to that point, which included a far lefty telecom-owned website called WorkingForChange.com, let that sink in, were suddenly not very interested in my point of view. And so I was rooting around for new things. And I had noticed that at least at that time, there were a lot of heretofore social conservatives who after 9/11 were like, you know what, maybe I'm going to stop yakking about the gay marriage because, you know, that the same beliefs are held by the people who just blew down our buildings. And so I pitched that as a web piece originally for Nick. Actually, the first pitch was similar to that. And he said, no. How about this other, you know, sentence that you put in there? So the first thing that I wrote was in like October of 2001. And then for the print magazine, I traced down the largely apocryphal kind of urban legend-ish story of whether U.S. sanctions had killed 500,000 Iraqi babies in the 1990s. And it turns out it's just a lot more complicated than all of that. And the answer is no, but and it's sort of a game of telephone thing tracing all of that. So that was my first piece for the magazine. So again,
which is a real venerable genre, I think, that we do just tracking down things that are kind of taken as part of the conventional wisdom and then oftentimes finding out either that the story is so vastly more complicated as to be unrecognizable or is just flat out wrong. And I know the real old timers at Reason talk a lot about a story about the Love Canal scandal in upstate New York and Niagara Falls, which had to do with a housing development in the 70s being built on a former chemical dump and supposedly giving rise to like super high rates of birth defects and other kinds of cancers and diseases of people living there. And it was one of those stories that helped propel an entire generation or era of regulation of chemical companies and of corporations. It was very much of a piece with a loss in belief and trust in large institutions, whether it was the government or business or the press or whatever. But it turned out that the actual malefactor in the Love Canal situation was the Board of Education in Niagara Falls, which owned the property, had bought it from a chemical company with a rider saying they could never develop it or sell it for houses. And they were like, yeah, we don't give a shit. And it was a great early Reason story that took what everybody knew to be true and complicated it and showed that the bad actors were the people who were constantly claiming to be acting in your best interest. Your dead baby story, Matt, I thought was similar to that in that it tracked down, you know, these facts that constantly are being bruited about as if, you know, they're parts of the physical landscape. And in fact, they're kind of invented and they're kind of made up and they gather a life and an urgency and a potency that they don't really deserve.
Over the next week, beginning on Tuesday morning, we are going to be highlighting some of our work during this previous calendar year, I should say, in that vein and in other veins. Please check it out. Have fun. Leave comments and donate, for crying out loud, reason.com/webathon, or just go to the blog and follow the various links. That is all the time that we have for here. Thank you for listening very much. Remember, you can subscribe to The Reason Podcast on iTunes. Please do rate and review us there while you are there. And until next time, this has been The Reason Podcast.